it was as smooth as it could be. I'm going to allow Rabbi Grunstein to take over. I'm assuming everybody here does know Rabbi Grunstein. I'm looking at the list. I'm assuming everyone knows him. So I'll let you. I see not everyone does. So in case anyone was on here that didn't know Rabbi Grunstein, was the rabbi in Beth Israel for 4 years, from 2003 to 7 or 2 to 6?
3 to 7.
2 to 6. To 3 to 7. And now he's the he's doing I keep forgetting what's called outreach for Tzohar in North America, and I'm going to let him take it away and just tell us what you think about the film, how that does it really reflect on some of the realities that are happening in Israel, and tell us about what Tzohar is doing for that. And if I'm not here at the end, I just want to thank you in advance, only because I'm at a Shavuot Brachos here with my family. So if I'm not here, I really want to thank you for doing this and partaking, and hopefully we'll do more programming together. So take it away.
Okay, thank you so much, Rabbi Kirzner. A good afternoon, everyone. I thank God see many familiar faces here on the Zoom. Some people I don't know, but you'll see as we go along, I'm not that scary. And at any point, feel free to ask questions. First of all, beyond being a pleasure to see you, it was very difficult for me to watch that film. I believe that that film showed a very real situation here in Israel today. And I'm going to try to paraphrase it very telegraphically with my own kids. Some of you remember my son Noam. He's now serving in the army. He's in the Navy. He lives in Efrat, where basically 99% of the people here are from Jews. They're observant Jews. Now, he grew up with a girl who basically was in class with him since we came back to Israel in 2007, as the rabbi mentioned. They basically grew up together. As you saw in the film, they went to a youth group together called Bnei Akiva, high school and whatnot. Because bat mitzvahs here are basically celebrated with a party, no one went ahead and asked if she was halachically Jewish at 12. Now she's 20, 22, thinking of getting married to a nice religious boy, and she finds out she's not Jewish. They grew up together. They have the same upbringing, basically. There's no difference between them. The only difference is my son Noam's mother is Jewish and her mother is not. That is an occurrence in Israel today in almost every single city and town, including the religious ones, for one reason. It's called the law of return. How many people here heard of the law of return? Excellent. So you know very well that the law of return says that anti-Nuremberg laws, you can basically come to Israel if not only your mother was Jewish, but if your father was Jewish, grandfather was Jewish, or great-grandfather was Jewish. And therefore, in Israel today, we have 1.5 million people that came from Russia. Of them, I believe at least half are not halachically Jewish. And the question is, like in the film, what do we do? This is people that grew up in Israel. They're basically as Israeli and as Jewish in their feeling as anyone else. The only difference is they're not halachically Jewish, technically. How do we deal with it on a national level? So without going into every single solution out there, allow me to say three things on this issue. Number one, it is absolutely outrageous to me that there are rabbis out there today that say the following. It's not our fault. What do you want from us? We didn't make the law of return. We didn't bring all these non-Jews into Israel, so we don't have to do anything to rectify the situation. It's not our responsibility. I find that outrageous because I was a rabbi, as you all know, in Halifax. I didn't decide what the reality would be. The reality was thrust upon me based on where the Jews were between 2003 and 2007. I didn't come to Halifax and say, well, it's not my fault that you have a bar mitzvah, and it's not my fault that you want to get married. That's the reality, and rabbis have to respond to reality. That's the way it's been from the time the Torah was given at Sinai. The reality is, whether we like it or not, there are many, many non-Jews in Israel today that feel Israeli, are part of Israeli society, and we as rabbis and as halachic deciders have to do something about it. Because if not, we're going to have intermarriage and not assimilation. Namely, they're living in Israel, they feel Jewish. It happens to be they're not Jewish, and they're going to marry our kids. And that is a time-ticking bomb that's right now happening in Israel, and the question is, what do we do about it? At the organization that I'm privileged to join about a month ago, we have two solutions that are rather simple, if you look at it from a technical point of view. The first solution is to establish that you are Jewish, and the second solution is to become Jewish if you're not. So, if we can end here, Rabbi Kirzner, two simple solutions. Either establish you're really Jewish, or just become Jewish. And we can end the Zoom right here. The problem is, it's not so simple to say the least. First of all, let's start at the beginning. I sent the link in the chat to the compartment within Sohar that I'm working at today called Shorashim. Shorashim means roots in Hebrew. Basically, these are experts authorized by the highest court in Israel, the Beit Din HaGadol, and all the Batei Din, all the courts of Israel, to establish Jewishness for people that can't prove it, if it's possible. Now, what does that mean? I'm going to be very, very simple and telegraphic. I'll use someone here on the Zoom that I know. Arthur and Kathy Zilbert that are tuning in from Toronto, great to see you. Arthur and Kathy decide one day they want to make Aliyah to Israel. And they want to prove that they're Jewish, so they're eligible for Aliyah. All they have to do is to do two things. Do you all remember the movie The Terminal with Tom Hanks? Remember, he was stuck in JFK because his country, while he was on the plane, became desolate. Or to be more precise, it's still there, but it's no longer a country. So he didn't have a valid passport. He spent 2 years in the terminal. The customs officer told him that in my job, there's three things you need. The person, the document, and the story. So Arthur and Kathy want to make Aliyah. They basically need two people. They come to the Aliyah office in Toronto. Number two, they need documents. So they're going to take out the ketubah, the marriage document that they got at their Jewish wedding. And they're going to bring a letter from their local rabbi that hopefully is on the authorized lists of rabbis here in Israel. That's a conversation that's not for today. And they're going to say, we lived in Halifax, we moved to Toronto, here are our documents. They'll be in and out of the office within minutes, and they'll be eligible for Aliyah. I will say, Arthur and Kathy, if you're thinking of doing this tomorrow, COVID may stop you for a few months, so we'll talk afterwards. But in a perfect world, no COVID, that's what you got to do. Russian Olim cannot do that for a simple reason. A, we have the person. B, we do not have the documents. These are people that got married when there was the Soviet Union, not Russia, and therefore there were no documents. There were no rabbis to marry them. And even if they got married clandestinely, they made sure to hide the documents. So there are no documents. They may have a story, but they don't have documents. So how do they prove they're Jewish? So they come before the rabbi or the rabbinic court, and they bring a story, whatever the story might be. We set up a whole department that deals with these cases that basically says, we will look for those documents to establish before the Jewish court that you're Jewish. We have two full-time offices in Ukraine, one in Russia, and of course, one in Jerusalem that travels all around Israel. And this is what they do. I'll give you a live case. There was a lady that came and said, I want to get married to a Jew, and I'm Jewish, because my grandmother was Jewish. They said, but you have a non-Jewish last name, for a bunch of generations, for that matter. So she gave the following story. Here's the person with the story. No documents. When the Nazis finally invaded Russia, they came to my grandparents' town. They gathered up all the Jews and they started marching them to the forest to do exactly to them what they did to the Jews in Babi Yar. I'm sure you know the story. My grandmother figured out what's about to happen. And I don't have to tell people here, Russians by definition are very bright people. And they're very observant in the sense of they catch things quickly. And therefore, she understood they're about to be killed. So she told her daughter, go back home to dad, non-Jewish husband of mine, and tell him it's too cold for you to be outside, which was a cold word for that family. She came home, She told her dad, non-Jewish dad, mom said it's too cold. The non-Jewish father took the daughter to his parents, non-Jewish grandparents, and joined his wife in the forest, and he was killed together with all the Jews, a righteous Gentile. This is the story she told, and she said, therefore, my grandmother is Jewish, but I was raised by my non-Jewish grandparents. I'm 100% Jewish by birth. The rabbi said, this is an extraordinary story, and it should be leaked to the papers, but how do we know it's true? We don't have a document. We sent a person to her old village. He spent 2 weeks there going through archives, library, asking people. Eventually, he established a document, a newspaper article from then, telling the entire story as she told it. Now, obviously, in the 1940-whatever, that story was not written to establish Jewishness. There was no vested interest. It was a story that was written innocently. The newspaper article was translated, brought back to Israel, and thank God this person got married Jewishly. That's just one of many stories that happen every day in our department called Shorashim. I sent you the link. Their job is to establish Judaism when there's no documents, find the documents, and establish Judaism. We do this mainly for Russian Olim, simply because they don't have documentation. If and when we get a case from Canada, it's rather simple because there is documentation. It's readily available. You just have to find it based on the laws and regulations involved. Now, I will tell you that halachically, if a Jew comes and says, I'm Jewish, you don't have to check their Jewishness. You can accept them to become members of your synagogue. That was the Psak Halacha. That was the decision of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. I don't know if you heard the name, but shake your head and pretend you did. Founder of the Shas Party, if that tells you anything. He died a few years ago. Even though he died a few years ago, he's still the leader of the Shas Party. They will never defy anything he said. He said, when the Russians say they're Jewish, that's good enough. Unfortunately, that was not accepted in Israel. And therefore, we have these four offices. Their entire job is to establish Jewishness based on halachic methodology that we've established. So that's the first thing you can do for this young boy in the film. He believes he's Jewish. He acts observant. The only thing you need to do is to establish it. However, the second thing you need to do is when you can establish it, you can become a Jew. That's called conversion. Conversion in Israel today is a very, very hot topic. Now, why is it so hot? When I made this Zoom with the rabbi, I didn't know how hot it's going to be. But the news is on right now. After I finish with you, because of the magic of technology, I can watch the news, even though it's not 8 o'clock. It's now 8 o'clock p.m. in Israel, and I have this magic TV. Don't ask me how this works. Anytime I put on the TV, I can go to any program that was on already and watch it from the beginning. So I'm going to watch the news, and it's going to be an item, if not this week, but next week, that said on Sunday in Israel, the government met. Now, Hedda saying to me, what do you mean Sunday the government met? Sunday's a day off. When I lived in Halifax, there were blue laws on Sunday. The only stores that were open were the convenience stores and Pete's Frutique. Is it still around, by the way? Oh my gosh, that store is still around. God bless him. But then the blue laws were canceled, so the stores became open during our last year in Halifax. So we didn't really enjoy it as much. Because you understand that on Shabbos we didn't buy anything, and Sunday we didn't buy anything. So, quite frankly, Hed is looking at me, what do you mean the government met on Sunday? Answer, in Israel there is no Sunday. Sunday is Monday, and Monday's Monday number two. That's the first day of work for the week. They say Friday's the day off, but those on this Zoom that may have been in Israel understand Friday's not a day off. I always say Friday will be a day off when at the end of it you can have a barbecue. But you all know Friday leads into Shabbos, which means Friday is a very tense day of preparations for Shabbos. In any case, that's like saying that the eve of the Seder is a day off. In any case, today's the first day, and there should have been a reform brought to the government that says the following. As opposed to the situation today, every city rabbi in Israel can now do formal conversions in Israel. The situation today is that formal conversions are only done by the rabbinic court, which are in a few places in Israel. They have no jurisdiction over what they do. They have to issue decisions based on what the chief rabbi told them. From our perspective, that means that even if a case comes before them, they don't really decide, should we convert, shouldn't we convert? They're just clerks that are bringing out the policy of the chief rabbi. This reform says, A, every single city rabbi in Israel, who goes through even higher testing for ordination than myself, will have the right to make decisions about conversion. Can have his own court and make policy decisions. And B, most importantly for our conversation, they can deal with this problem. What do I mean? Right now in the state of Israel, this is the situation. We have endless Russians that came on Aliyah from Russia, or their children or their grandchildren, that are not halachically Jewish. Now, the answer is, if we can't establish Judaism, we can convert them. But in order to convert, it's a process, and not everyone's interested in that process. And even if they're interested in that process, they may not be interested in the standards needed. In order to become Jewish as an adult, you need to accept upon yourself the mitzvot. Namely, I'm going to accept upon myself not seven Noahide commandments that every human being is obligated in, but 613 commandments, plus many rabbinic laws and customs. I don't want to do that. And it's your God-given right to say, I don't want to do that. So, in general, there is a school of thought in Israel that says you can convert without accepting mitzvot, but that is not widely accepted for adults, as far as I know. So that's not going to be an option. So, the first option is to say, accept mitzvot and become observant. A select few will go with that. It won't be a solution for the masses. In the movie, we found an example of such a person. But I think you saw what the problem was. He thought he was Jewish. He felt Jewish. And you're telling him at the age of 18, 19, or 20, when his entire life, he never ate pig. He always fasted on Yom Kippur. He came to shul 3 times a day. You're not Jewish. And he gets offended, and probably rightfully so. And therefore, many of them will say, no, thank you. So I don't know if that's a solution today. The second solution is to convert them without accepting mitzvot. As I said, that's not a solution that's widely accepted. I'll just explain it in a minute. They accept upon themselves mitzvot, but they never intend to keep it. Namely, they say to the Beis Din, we accept all the mitzvot, but we're not planning to keep them. We're willing to be punished by God for eating pig and for eating on Yom Kippur. It's a solution, but it's not widely accepted. The third solution that Sohar, where I particularly work, is associated with, is to say for the adults, we have no solution, unless they become observant Jews. There is a solution, though, for the children. Under Bar Bat Mitzvah, says the Gemara in Ketubot, page 11a, you can convert children if you feel that it's a good idea. They don't have to become observant. The Gemara says that if you go ahead and you convert an adult, it can only be if it's to their benefit. But for an adult, it's not for their benefit if they're not going to accept mitzvot, for the following reason. They're going to eat pig every Sunday, and they're going to violate Shabbos every Saturday. Right now, they're doing it permissibly. The minute you convert them, they're doing it as a prohibition. They're doing something wrong. Why put them in that situation? So that's not an option for adults, says the Gemara, but it is for children. So children, the question is it an option even if the parents don't convert? Certain rabbis said no. They have to be from observant families to convert. And that's the current policy of the chief rabbinate. And others say no. With children, you can convert them even if their parents are not observant, and they're not going to be observant probably. And that's basically the solution that we are suggesting now. Adults, either they become observant or we can't convert them. But children, we're willing to do in the state of Israel for the following reason. Have you visited Israel? How many people here visited Israel? Okay. Let's assume you were with a friend who wants non-kosher meat. Like, they have this lust. They need non-kosher meat. The kosher meat's too salty. Is it easy to find, or is it difficult to find? You'd have to wake up very early in the morning, have two coffees with real sugar, no sweetener, and then you'd have to put on your Waze and your Google Maps, and you'd have to work very hard to find non-kosher food in Israel. The day of rest is Shabbos and Yontif. Namely, the days off in this country are Saturday, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Simchas Torah, Pesach 1, Pesach 2, and onwards. In a Jewish country, maybe the kids won't be observant, but A, you can convert them even without being observant, and B, they'll be living in a Jewish picture frame, and therefore, we feel that's the right way to go. And certain rabbis of cities under this reform feel the same way, and that can be a solution for the masses. Now, just in case you think that's a crazy solution, allow me to share with you one of the primary people that support it. His name was Rav Moshe Feinstein. If you ever ate a Hershey bar, or if you ever drank milk under governmental supervision, not Chalav Yisrael, but what's called regular milk from the supermarket, it's all because of him. He was an innovator in Jewish law and widely accepted for that matter. In any case, someone asked him the following question. I'm teaching in a school. My students, part of them are Jewish and part of them are half Jewish, namely not Jewish. There is a prohibition, as you saw in the movie, of teaching a non-Jew Torah. What the parameters are is a question in and of itself. Suffice it to say, I dealt with it on my second day in Halifax. My second day in Halifax, we had to make a decision. Do we unite the Hebrew schools as amalgamated ones or not? And part of the discussion was, can you teach Torah to non-Jews? Because that was part of the student population. Suffice it to say, he gives parameters, what's allowed, what's not allowed when you teach Torah to non-Jews. And then he says, but why do that? Just convert the children. They're young. They're under bar bat mitzvah. Just convert them. And then you have no question. Namely, he feels that it's a privilege to be Jewish, even if the parents won't be observant, as long as you're under the age of bar bat mitzvah. So to sum up, before I hear your questions, we are involved in many different things. But for sake of this movie and this problem, we do two things. Number one, an entire department to establish Judaism called Shorashim. And number two, we are for the conversion reform, which will give the power to city rabbis to convert people, not adults, but rather children under bar bat mitzvah, even if their parents are not observant, as long as A, they're planning to live in the Jewish country, and B, they're not planning to go out of their way to find non-kosher food, etc., but live like every other Israeli does. Those are the two solutions we suggest. Either establish Judaism or become Jewish as long as you're under bar bat mitzvah, or above if you want to become observant as well. That's the way we're dealing with this issue right now that you saw in the movie, which is vivid now. It's on the street, we feel it, and it's happening everywhere, including in religious towns like the one I live in. Love to hear your comments and questions. Go right ahead.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Yes, Alan.
The question is that like in Toronto and other cities, we have, in Canada, we have like two conversions. A conversion that people say they're Jewish and they, I forgot what the, how it's conversion goy or something it's called. And we have the other conversion that Christians take. Can't those people convert in Toronto, the first one, like the easier one, like,
okay.
So like a conversion?
I don't want to comment on what happens in Toronto because I believe that the Torontonian rabbis are the ones to decide what's best for Toronto. You're correct that there are conversion courts that ask for higher standards, lower standards, or whatnot. Obviously, Jewish courts, not conversion to Christianity or anything like that, Jewish courts, and Orthodox ones for that matter. However, I will tell you the following. There is a big difference between converting children in Toronto and converting children in Israel. Converting children in Toronto is not just making them Jewish, but you have to have parents that say, we want to raise them Jewish, which, as you know, in Toronto is a very costly statement. It's very expensive to keep kosher. It's very expensive to send your children to Jewish schools. And I have to admit that even if you're willing to do it, you're going against the trend, because the majority of people in Toronto are not Jewish, and you can get everything I just said for free. School is, you can go to public school for free, unless you choose private school, and you don't have to eat kosher food. So from this perspective, to go ahead and to say, well, just convert children, even though they won't be observant, it's possible. But maybe what you're doing is you're creating a situation where the highest probability is that they won't continue living a Jewish lifestyle. In Israel, on the other hand, I have to admit, as I said earlier, the education is a Jewish one, and it's free, or slightly free, in Israel. The kosher food is the only food available for most supermarkets, and therefore they're going to live in a Jewish environment anyway. So therefore, not only are you converting children under bar bat mitzvah, which, as I said earlier, is easier halachically, you're doing it in a Jewish country where it's more natural to live a Jewish lifestyle.
And it turns
next question. Oh, we want to. I'm sorry?
A child is 12 years old, or are you talking about 20 years old?
20 years old, they need to be observant if they want to convert, and not everyone's willing to take that upon themselves, and I understand that completely. But under the age of bar bat mitzvah, they don't have to be observant. I'll say differently. Even if they say they're going to be observant, it means nothing, because they're under bar bat mitzvah. They're still children. Okay.
Rabbi,
yes, Victor.
I'm sure you have thought forward. What happens when this, under the age of bar bat mitzvah, converts or has a conversion? Life goes on. They do get married. They move out of Israel. And maybe they have children. So they move to it could be Halifax, Nova Scotia, where you all know even a conversion is extremely difficult. So is this person considered Jewish and the kids considered Jewish?
Excellent question, Victor. Allow me to divide my answer into two, halachic and political. A, halachically. Halachically, they're 100% Jewish. Unless at the age of 12 and 13, they got up in the morning and said that day, I do not want to be Jewish, they are 100% Jewish, according to the majority of authorities, biblically, for the rest of their lives. So there's no question. You may not have liked what the court did, namely to convert children without their mother converting or without making sure they're going to live in an observant home. What was done is done, and they're 100% Jewish. That's the halachic answer. Now comes the political answer. Once you deal with the halacha, let's deal with the political fallout. Today in the world, not just in Halifax, every conversion is suspicious and considered not valid by the other person. It's a terrible situation. It's anti-halachic, if you ask me. But quite frankly, that's the situation. If the chief rabbinate of Israel converts someone, and that person now wants to get married, even though they were converted by the chief rabbinate themselves, a registrar of marriage of the chief rabbinate can question the conversion. All the more so is, as you said, they move out of Israel to another community. They'll look at the conversion document and they'll start questioning the conversion. It's 100% wrong. There's no halachic basis for it. It's 100% going against prohibitions of the Torah, in which you are causing harm, not just to a fellow Jew, but to a convert. Two prohibitions involved. But it is done today everywhere. Unfortunately. And therefore, any time someone moves from community A to community B, this is happening, and it's awful. And unless you know the rabbi that converted, and the court and whatnot, your conversion, unfortunately, will be questioned, unless people like us smooth it out for you, call the rabbi ahead of time, explain the conversion and this and that, and then things go smoothly. But quite frankly, it's an awful situation politically. I hope that in a few years' time, I'll be able to answer your question with just A and not B.
Thank you.
You can ask about other things in Israel. It doesn't have to be about conversion and establishing Judaism. If anyone has any other comments or questions, with pleasure.
I think that the ramifications of what's going on is a lot broader than what we were, what we've been discussing so far. I got married in Israel approximately 30 years ago, and my mother and father were married in England in the 1940s or 50s by a conservative rabbi with whom she converted. So when I got to Israel, I was there for 9 years. We both had good jobs. We were both reasonable people, and I would suggest that Israel is needs as many reasonable people as she can get in terms of what's happening in politics there. And we were working well. We were contributing our taxes. I totally thought I was Jewish, just like the person in there, because I decided it, right? And that was my decision. I moved to Israel and I studied there, etc. And we had to, when I was forced to go to Cyprus to get married, I there was a conservative rabbi who married us in Israel, but it wasn't recognized. A lot of my husband's family was Orthodox. They didn't come to the wedding. It was a huge thing. And when I went to Cyprus, the humiliation I felt was the end of me. I left Israel. I said, I'm not living here. I'm not living where they're telling me what my identity is. So you're actually losing this gap between the law and the religious that lets them, determine who's Jewish and the other ones determine who can get married as a Jew. It's not working, and you're actually losing, Israel's really losing out by it.
I would like to comment on what you said, because I believe your story is a very typical story of what happens in Israel. And that is the following. When Sohar, where I am privileged to work, started, they started with one issue, weddings. Why did they start with weddings? Rabin's assassination was the reason Sohar started. When Rabin was assassinated in 1995, any Jew walking around with a kippah, or any girl dressed modestly like a religious girl is dressed, was called a murderer. It was like anyone with a kippah could murder a prime minister. And the strife was awful. Sohar was founded. The first thing they did, before anything I spoke about, was weddings. Now what does that mean? The chief rabbinate, as you know, in Israel, is the only body that's allowed to marry and divorce in Israel. It's a bit of coercion, maybe even more than a bit. It's religious coercion, because they're telling you this is the only way to marry in Israel, and it's Jewishly and Orthodox. But that doesn't mean that it has to be done in a mean way. Namely, there are standards, but it could be said with a smile. And if there's problems, we can try to solve them. Not all the time is every problem solvable. Sometimes, indeed, it's a non-Jew to a Jew, and a rabbi has to throw up their hands and say, I'm sorry, but the answer is no. Not easy to say, but sometimes you have to. But until you get there, look how many things you can do. First of all, establish Judaism. Second of all, suggest conversion. There's many things that could be done to help a couple. And even if the answer at the end is, I'm sorry, I can't help you, doesn't mean it has to be done in a vicious way. The same thing could be said in a nice way. When we started out, you know where our three standards were for being an officiator at a wedding? You know what they were? Okay. The three standards I'm going to tell you, I want everyone to try not to laugh. But these were three standards that were unheard of in Israel when Sohar started out. Standard number one, you cannot officiate at the wedding unless you meet the couple before the wedding. And you don't meet them only under the chuppah. Standard number two. You must come on time and dress appropriately. Not everyone's laughing yet. Okay. See, when I was told this, you know what? I'll tell you what standard number three was. Standard number three, you cannot accept payment for the wedding. They'll pay you back for your transportation to get there and back, taxi, gas, whatever. You cannot accept payment. Those were the three standards of an officiator of a wedding from Tzohar. Now, when I heard this coming back to Israel and they offered me to be one of them, when I came back to Israel from Halifax, I cracked up laughing. I said, "You're joking. Rabbis come late to weddings and they meet the couple under the chuppah." They said, "Yes, that's what happens in Israel. You go register for marriage at a local rabbinate. They assign a rabbi to you. He doesn't know you. They don't know, you don't know them. He comes to the wedding, meets you under the chuppah, says the mumbo jumbo, and leaves. And of course asks for 500 shekel, which is against the law for many rabbis, because it's done, A, against the law if you're an official rabbi in Israel of a town or a city, and B, even if it's not against the law, they usually don't report it to the IRS, or to Revenue Israel, as you call it in Canada. These were the three standards. It caused a revolution in Israel. The numbers of Jews going to Cyprus to get married civilly outside of Israel went down. We marry by year 4,000 couples, and we need more rabbis to do it because we're running out. More and more couples are coming. All because, not because we changed one standard. None. Everything the rabbinate asks for, we do. And by the way, we cross every T and dot every I. Do you know why, Charlotte? Because they're constantly looking at us with suspicion. You know, a rabbi, clean shaven, or a trim beard, knitted yarmulke, he's suspicious. He doesn't look like a rabbi. He doesn't smell like a rabbi. So ultimately, they're always looking to make sure every single last piece of document is there, and we make sure to do it. Having said that, I've married many couples already. Not just them, but their sister and their brother and their friend. For a very simple reason, I didn't take off one standard of the rabbinate. I just say it with a smile. And our office staff does exactly the same thing. Not to mention the fact that they make it accessible. What does it mean, accessible? Let's take another example from this Zoom. Carol Lee's on the Zoom. Carol Lee has a granddaughter or a grandson getting married in Israel. They have to register for marriage. You have to go to the rabbinate office. They're learning in Tel Aviv University. According to the laws of the state of Israel that was changed 6 years ago, they have to go to the place that they live. They can't register in Tel Aviv. Namely, during their lunch break, they can't simply take a taxi 2 minutes away. They have to go to, if they live in a lot, 4 hours away to register there. That was changed by us. We basically came and said, it's all computerized today. So what does it make a difference if you register here, you register there? You're in Halifax, I'm in Israel, I'm talking to you by Zoom. Everything's recorded. So quite frankly, why do you need to go to a lot to register just because that's where you live? We changed that. Now, every standard is kept. The only thing that changed was accessibility. On Tel Aviv University, there's a branch where you can go and register for marriage. So I think that what you're describing is basically not a question of standards. It's a question of how do you convey those standards to people? Do you do it with a smile or do you do it with a huff? And allow me to share a story that happened to me in Halifax. I don't know how many people know. I think I told the story to a few people here. I'm sitting in my office one day in the Beth Israel Synagogue, the office that Rabbi Kirzner now occupies. Knock on the door. Someone wants to see me. At that time, I had office hours in the morning. I don't know how I did it, but from like 9 to, I forgot, I was in the office. You can come in. And they basically tell me that they are engaged and they'd like to be married. Now, this is rare that in Halifax, a Jewish boy and a Jewish girl wanted to get married. I checked out their Judaism. There's no question of Judaism. I was so excited. There's going to be a wedding. I can literally tell you how many weddings I had in Halifax as an officiator. Not even one hand. That's the fingers on one hand. 4 years, didn't finish them. This is a case. I'm so excited. Right away, I foresee there's going to be a wedding. We're going to help a couple out. 2 weeks before the wedding, in order to establish Judaism, he sent me the pictures of his grandparents' tombstone. On the tombstone, there was a picture like Dr. Spock. You remember Dr. Spock from Star Trek? You remember this? What does this symbolize? Anyone?
Kohen.
A Kohen. The lady was not a convert. She was a divorcee. For reasons that are beyond me, a divorcee cannot marry a Kohen. That's a biblical law. I tried very hard to say maybe she's not a divorcee because her first marriage was not a good marriage. But it turned out the rabbi who did the first marriage did a wonderful job, did it well. She was absolutely a divorcee. She had a get. And ultimately, as much as I tried, there was nothing I can do. When I called them in to tell them that, I burst out in tears. Not just because I cannot marry them Jewishly. They weren't observant, so that wasn't like the end of all for them. I basically said, in a nice way, according to Jewish law, I can't marry you because you're not allowed to be married. And it hurt me because this is a Jewish boy and a Jewish girl in a world in which many people were intermarrying. But because I said it with sadness and not with a huff, I didn't come and tell them, hey, you're a divorcee, you're a Kohen, no way, and you should divorce. Then ultimately we remain friends. We remain friends. We email each other from time to time. To this day, they did not get married Jewishly. And quite frankly, we remain friends. And more importantly, forget about me, they didn't get a sour feeling about Judaism because of that. They're still members of a synagogue today, not in Halifax. Now, take that very same story, and I'm going to tell you a decision from the Beis Din in Israel. There was a Beis Din in Israel that got the following case. There was a husband. His Judaism was questionable. They sent him to one of our departments in Shor HaShim. We established Judaism based on documentation and everything I said. The court accepted the decision and said they can marry. Now you're ready for the clincher? This I couldn't believe. This, when they told me this, I said, you made this up. In the decision, it was written. We told the girl, why do you have to rely on documentation? Maybe he's Jewish, maybe not. Just find another husband. That's totally Jewish. Now, these are rabbis. They learned endless years in yeshiva. I would assume they have at least half a brain. And they wrote to a woman about to get married to her beloved one, why don't you find another husband? Don't be so picky. Why? To solve a halachic issue of maybe he's not Jewish. After we established Judaism. Now you understand from that decision, they did not leave with a nice taste in their mouth about Judaism, about rabbis, about Jewish law. In this job, I have to tell you, Charlotte, I think Arthur heard this from me in his living room many times. I said this endless times. Judaism is perfect. The Jews are not. Judaism is perfect. The Jews are not. That's something that a great rabbi called the Maverick Rabbi, rabbi of the West Side Institutional Synagogue said, Rabbi Goldstein, may he rest in peace, Herbert Goldstein. And that's a line that I literally have as my screensaver for many years on my computer. Judaism is perfect, the Jews are not.
I suppose, I don't want to take over. Does anybody else want to say anything?
Yeah, maybe we should hear another question. But thank you for bringing it up.
I have one more question, sorry.
Go right ahead.
Couple moves to Israel. She had a conservative, or she had a non-recognized, I guess, conversion. They moved to Israel. She's Jewish, and in fact, you know, irrelevant, I guess, if she was Shomer Shabbos, kosher, whatever, but her conversion was not an Orthodox conversion. They have a child in Israel. Does that child have to be converted to be considered Jewish?
The answer is yes, but let me start from the beginning of your question. if they had a conservative conversion, they can make aliyah to Israel under the law of return. Just like the law of return allows non-Jews, but with Jewish ancestry, to make aliyah, father Jewish, grandfather Jewish, etc. So too, if your conservative rabbi writes you a letter that you're Jewish or you're converted according to the conservative way of doing things, you can make aliyah to Israel and become an Israeli citizen. Having said that, the rabbinate does not recognize you as Jewish, and yes, you would have to convert again. That is a typical case of what I was talking about. Namely, the parents are Jewish. Yes, they were in a conservative temple, but they went out of their way to convert. So at least, you see, they're connected to the Jewish people. They made aliyah to Israel, which is a second indication of their strong connection to the Jewish people. It doesn't mean the child's Jewish. The child does need to be converted. And if they're under bar bat mitzvah, it would be possible. Above bar bat mitzvah, they would have to be observant and would be more sophisticated and complex.
Okay. Thank you.
By the way, Victor, what you just described happens in Israel in a different way. And I'll explain. The Sephardic Jews are very traditional. They never lost the tradition. You could have a Sephardic Jew that's not Shomer Shabbos, but puts on tefillin every day. Makes Kiddush Friday night. He goes to the soccer game Shabbos afternoon. But very, very traditional. And I don't know to this day how they, the Sephardic community, somehow retained that connection far more than Ashkenazic Jews. That Sephardic Jew is married to a Russian Olah that's not Jewish. And she's not planning to convert nor keep mitzvot. But she doesn't have any other religion. She was from the Soviet Union. So basically she says, whatever my husband wants to raise the kids in terms of religion is good enough for me. He wants to send them to a modern Orthodox institution to go to school, fine. That's a typical case in Israel that I'm talking about. The father, very traditional, wants his kids to have a Jewish education and basically be raised as Jews. Not observant, but very traditional. In that case, under bar bat mitzvah, it would be possible. On the other hand, Victor, I'll be honest with you. If you have two parents and they go to church on Sunday in Israel, which is as difficult as finding non-kosher food, that's not the case that I would suggest converting. Because they really have no connection to the Jewish people outside of living here. But ultimately, if there is a connection, like you suggested in the conservative conversion, or my case of the Sephardic Jew married to the non-Jew, I believe the kids should be converted. Yes, I'm sorry,
hi,
your
Ash,
name.
Ash, Blumenfeld. Okay, hi. So
your name, please.
Going to Asha Blumenfeld.
Asha.
Abigail. Yeah. Yeah.
Abigail.
So, yes. Okay, so my question is, both in the, I think in the movie, the most disturbing thing was that this young man, after finding that there's an issue with his halachic, you know, status, he finds it humiliating on many levels. I mean, the examples that we have that, you know, when he says, shelas ani goy, and then when he, you know, cannot touch the, I mean, when he touches the wine and that causes a whole issue. There are a few elements where it's just personally humiliating. And I have a very close friend whose background is Sephardic, and she came to Toronto. And because her parents were kind of like flower children in hippie times, you know, and then passed away pretty early in her life, she didn't have any documentation. She had to go through conversion, even though she was nothing but Jewish, which she also found humiliating in some ways. Not that conversion in itself is humiliating, but, you know, having your status questioned and your identity questions, just like we saw in the movie. So when you say Jews are not perfect, but Judaism is, like, I find that part a little bit disturbing, you know, like I think many people, that it's this kind of unwelcoming attitude, the humiliating sort of attitude, like this kind of thing. That I'm not sure if I'm making it clear what I mean, but I found it a little bit disturbing.
You're making it perfectly clear, and allow me to answer by saying the following. When a convert comes to any based in any Jewish court around the world, and they're totally not Jewish, they just want to become Jewish. There's no Jewish connection there whatsoever. You usually, according to the Talmud, codified by Jewish law, have to tell them, why do you want to be Jewish? Think about it. Rethink it. That's what we colloquially call pushing them away, even though there is no law to push them away. But basically, you tell them there's anti-Semitism, and the UN hates Israel, and even President Biden in the United States is not so amazing for Israel, and you're going to be part of this nation, and we have so many commandments and prohibitions, and what you try to do is basically tell them it's not easy to be Jewish, to say the least. That's what's colloquially called pushing them away. And even after they think about it, they come back and they say, okay, only then do you start a conversion process. That's with a real non-Jew. Now, take that same case to the movie. Is that a real non-Jew? The man basically thought he was Jewish. He grew up in a religious environment. He went to yeshiva. He is keeping all the laws of Judaism. He has a Jewish observant girlfriend. He's active in the Jewish movement for kids called Bnei Akiva. In that case, according to the not majority, but many, many deciders of Jewish law, you don't push them away. Quite the contrary. You do not act like the rabbis in the movie. The rabbis in the movie basically said, you're not Jewish, do what you want. You don't want to convert, don't convert. According to many rabbis that deal with conversion, historically and today, that's what we call Zera Yisrael, literally the seed of Israel. Namely, they come from Jewish blood. In that case, it's a mitzvah to do everything possible to outreach, inspire, and influence them to obviously convert. But not as outsiders like you saw in the movie, but as insiders. Namely, you've been doing this your entire life. Do you really want to throw it away? You can, but we suggest you don't. We're going to feel we're losing an amazing asset to the Jewish people if you don't convert, if you don't jump into the ocean, as we saw there. What you're describing happened to a convert that I dealt with, not in Israel, but in a different country. I won't say where. Suffice it to say, not in your neck of the woods, not in the continent of North America. The convert was basically, as you saw, brought up Jewish, basically in a Jewish home, went through high school, looked for a Jewish husband, as she was taught, found a Jewish husband, about to get married. They went to register for marriage, not in Israel, and they found out her mother had a questionable conversion, namely from the conservative movement in this case. Instead of the Dayanim, the Jewish court saying to her, listen, if you're not our sister, you're at least our first cousin, second cousin. We have a technical issue. Let's try to solve it. If we lose you, we're losing an asset to the Jewish people. Think about it. In the world we're living in today, she didn't assimilate. She looked for a Jewish husband. She wanted to get married Jewishly. She's planning to raise her kids Jewishly. So if you don't want to call her our sister, at least call her our cousin. That's not what the rabbis did. Like in the movie, they said, you're a Goya. You're a non-Jew. You know, we'll go through a conversion process. It will take 3 years. You understand very well that woman ran away from Judaism, from the rabbis, and from everyone. That day, like you saw in the movie. Exactly. Went into the taxi on Shabbos, ran away. 10 years later. Two kids and 10 years later. She approached a rabbi who approached me. And I asked her, I heard the story, terrible story. The rabbi should have outreached to you, in my opinion, but they did it. Why the change of heart? Why the change of heart? And the answer was, I don't want my kids to go through the same thing. And you should know, the day she converted, there wasn't a dry eye in the court. Not a dry eye. I heard the stories. I didn't have tears. I had earlier. What happened was her father was a Holocaust survivor. And all these years said, if I was Jewish enough for Hitler, I'm Jewish enough for you to be Jewish. Eventually he relented. It happened to be that the day she came to the Jewish court was Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. And you understand in Israel that's a very solemn day. I don't know if you've ever been here. Ron, you said you were in Israel. You ever hear Yom HaShoah? Okay, the music is solemn. There's no happy, clappy music. Television, only Holocaust-oriented programming. It's like a day of sadness from beginning to end, from night to night. That's the day she came to the Jewish court. And she told the story about her father saying, if I'm Jewish enough for Hitler, I'm Jewish enough for this. And she started to burst out in tears, saying how difficult it was to sort of come to qualms with the fact that she's not halachically Jewish. By the time she finished her story, the three rabbis were in tears. But it all started with one thing. This whole story, she eventually converted her kids as well. It all started with someone saying, you're not a foreigner coming into the Jewish people. You're our cousin. At the very least, there's a technical issue we need to solve. You may not want to, God-given right. But if you don't, we're going to call you in a year, and in 2 years, and in 3 years, until you do. And it should be on your agenda. I have, right here on my phone, I have a number of a lady that I've tried to do that to, have not been successful. Don't think every case I ever dealt with was successful. People here know, not all my years in Halifax were a story of success. I had my failures too. Well, quite frankly, she's one of my failures. A woman in a different country, I am trying to convince for 3 years now, please, I want you to not just be Jewish in your heart, in your mind, but in your status. Because she, her father's Jewish, her mother is not. And she says, I feel Jewish, like the boy in the film. The difference is, I'm not giving up. And I'm constantly calling her every half a year. She knows why I'm calling, and I'm trying very hard to say you're my cousin, and I want you to be my sister. So it's not the standards, it's not Jewish law, it's the way you convey it, and you're absolutely right. If you call them a goy, and if you call them a non-Jew, they'll run out of that court as fast as they came in, and you'll never see them again. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, your name. I don't know who you are.
Well, you have my iPad there, but you can call me Yosef.
Yosef, go right ahead.
All right, couple of things to comment on. My father, who was Ashkenazi, fought in the Russian army and in the Israeli army in 48, he was, like you said, those Sfaradim. He went to shul in the morning on Shabbat, and he went to the beach because he had a flatbed truck he owned back then. He went to the beach in the afternoon. And when he was dating my mother, he was the only one. She had three sisters. He was the only boy allowed to come on Shabbat because he came from a religious family in Israel, and all the other ones didn't. So I'm always amused by that. But couple of things. There's situations where you had Orthodox rabbis in conservative synagogues with YU Smicha, who 30 years ago, their conversions and their weddings weren't challenged, and today they seem to be challenged. You have a situation where people did convert Orthodox. The kids lived Orthodox for 20 or 30 years, and then in their 30s or 40s went away from it. And retroactively, you have Israeli courts trying to nullify their conversions. There's a famous case in Toronto of a famous person's children who that was the case. But so fundamentally, my question would be, isn't this a problem of giving the rabbinate in Israel the power of fiat, rather than trying to persuade you like the rabbinate in Halifax or North America does? When you give people absolute power, they lose the incentive to try and persuade you with kind words, with logical arguments, with the rest of it, and they just see it. I'm going to do it by brute force, and that's part of the problem. And that problem won't happen. It won't be solved until you reduce the amount of money being given for religious things in Israel, at least in my opinion.
Right. I have to say that Yosef, I 100% agree with you, and I'll explain to the people listening what I believe you're saying. Which I believe you're saying is, we have to go back to the model in Halifax, Toronto, Montreal, and every other place outside of Israel, where there is no chief rabbinate. Every rabbi decides, for their community, what's the best thing to do. In Israel, we have a chief rabbinate that sort of decides for the whole country what's good for them, not taking into consideration localized communities. Am I understanding you correctly?
I'm going beyond that.
You're going beyond it.
Because I'm saying you have here, you have to persuade people. And there you want to just say the fourth. Either you do it my way or it's the highway. And there's no competition. If you're saying that there should be competition amongst the various jurisdictions, and yes, some people will be attracted to more machmir jurisdictions, but not everybody will be. And you have to have the idea of respect. And this brings up what a friend of mine once said is the most important word in the Jewish lexicon, some. Some Jews do it this way, and some Jews do it that way.
Nice. I'm going to say as follows. We at Tzohar believe that competition is only doing good for the Jewish people and the Jewish law. And allow me to give you two examples. The first example is what I mentioned earlier, the registration of marriage. The minute that you can register for marriage anywhere in Israel, that led to a situation where everyone was registering with Tzohar and nobody was registering in other places. Right? What do you think happened, Yosef? The other places, because of competition, got better. All of a sudden, they offered you, if you come to go with us, we're going to give you a gift for your new home. All of a sudden, they said, if you come to register with us, it's a reduced rate. In other words, competition put down force and was good for the clientele. Example number two. Have you heard of the Kashrus reform that just passed? Unlike the conversion bill, the Kashrus reform already passed. It was absolutely Tsar's doing in many ways. What happened is as follows. Until now in Israel, the rabbinate of Efrat can only give Kashrus for Efrat. The rabbinate of, say, Tel Aviv was only able to give Kashrus in Tel Aviv. The law is now changed since the January 1st that any rabbinate can give Kashrus anywhere in Israel. Not very relevant because, quite frankly, the rabbinates don't have manpower to do it, but in certain places, they do. That causes competition. Next year, January 1st, 2023, the main reform starts, which says as follows. Any corporation that meets standards of kashrus can give kashrus in Israel. Right now, Tzohar has kashrus, but they can't call it kashrus. Only the chief rabbinate and the rabbinates of cities can call it kashrus. You know what Tzohar has to call their kashrus? Pikuach mazon, inspecting food. Everybody knows it means kashrus, but they can't call it kashrus. By the way, it's not just Tzohar, we're modern Orthodox. The Haredi ultra-Orthodox have exactly the same problem. They don't trust the rabbinate and the chief rabbinate's kashrus, so they have their own corporations. Again, they can't call it kosher. They can call it other names. Next year, January 1st, we can call it kosher. That's going to cause competition. Competition is going to cause, in my humble opinion, no changing of standards. Jewish law will remain the same. It's how you convey the standards and how you do it. Allow me to give you a post from Facebook this morning. Somebody went into a cafe that was under the kashrus of Tzohar and asked the manager, why did you change from the rabbinate to Tzohar? His answer, I quote, the rabbinate's kashrus, again, I don't know which city this is, so I'm not going ahead and saying libel against any city in Israel. I don't know where it is, but he posted it on Facebook. He said, the kashrus of the rabbinate, the gentleman came in once a week, said hello, and left. It cost me 2,000 shekel a month to get their hashgacha, to get their supervision. Unlike them, said the owner of the cafe, the Tzohar people come in once a day. They come in once a day, same price, 2,000 shekel. He goes into the kitchen, looks around, goes ahead and cleans the lettuce if need be, the leafy vegetables, makes sure things are okay, says hello, says goodbye, makes sure he's in there every single day. So why should I pay 2,000 shekel for once a week if I'm going to pay 2,000 shekel for every single day? So therefore I took Tzohar. Now the gentleman asked him, Had the standards changed? He said, no, same standards. No difference. I have to buy food from the same place, etc. There was no difference. It's just for 2,000 shekel, I'm getting an everyday mashgiach versus I'm getting a once-a-week mashgiach. Not to mention the fact that I'm going to add something that was not in his post, but I'm going to guess it. You ready for this? How many people giving kashrus don't eat from their own kashrus? I'm embarrassed to tell you that it's very high. Their mashgichim say for the OU, they give kashrus. I eat it. Carol Lee eats it. Everyone on the Zoom eats it. We serve it at the shul. They don't eat it. They need a higher standard of kashrus. You understand very well that if that happens, my trust in their kashrus goes down. Because if they're not eating from it, maybe it's questionable. Recently in Soar, the following thing made the papers. Not sure why, but it did. It said, not front page news, but within the paper, Yediot Achronot, I'm sure you know they're not the biggest lovers of Judaism, they wrote that the Tzor Mashgichim were told by our office not to receive any benefit from any place that you work. Our standard is you pay Tzohar, and Tzohar pays the Mashgichim. With the rabbinate, that's not the case. In many cases, the business pays the mashgiach. You understand very well that if the mashgiach says, hey, you violated kashrus, I'm closing down, he's not going to get paid. So he's very reluctant to do that. In Tzohar, they pay us, we pay the mashgichim. So there is no linkage. In any case, we told the mashgichim, you are not to get any benefit from the places you give ashgachav to. If they offer you a free meal, you say, no, thank you, I'm paying for it. If they offer you food that they're about to throw out on a Friday before Shabbos for your home to take home because it's going in the garbage anyway, you must say no. This made the papers in Israel saying it's a high moral level. Namely, they're giving a service, they're not getting anything in return. They're getting nothing in return. But more importantly, you know what's implied in that article? That the mashgichim will eat from their own kashrus. They have to be told not to, so they don't get benefit from the places they're supervising, but quite unless they pay for it. But quite frankly, they are eating from their own kashrus. Now you understand, the minute you have competition, all these things will happen. It's going to be natural. And therefore, we're for competition. We think it's only going to be good for kashrus, for Jewish weddings, and for Judaism, for that matter.
But Rabbi, that situation I thought of in Toronto about your question, and I asked, so if the guy closes somebody down, even if he's not getting the money directly, so the way I explained it, so the store gives COR a dollar, and COR gives the mashgiach 50 cents. If he's not guaranteed a job after the place gets closed down, it's still meaningless, because he knows where it's coming from. It's just a shell game where you're moving the money around. So
very good question.
Not so hard guaranteeing yeah. The money or reframing.
Answer, right now as I'm speaking to you, much to my personal dismay because it's my job to fundraise, Tzohar is the one fundraising for the kashrus. In other words, we do ask for money for kashrus, but we're not yet at a situation where we don't have to fundraise. The reason for that is many, but one of them is what you're bringing up. We don't want a situation where our mashgichim's job is dependent upon business. So they're paid a salary, regardless of how many businesses we have. We're hoping that as this law comes into fruition, we're going to have more businesses, and I won't have to fundraise. But yes, Tzohar at this moment is fundamentally ensuring that they get a salary regardless of how many businesses we have. Now, obviously, we're not hiring 25,000 mashgichim for no reason. We're hiring based on needs. But those, again, it's not dependent one on the other. Okay, everyone. I thank you all for listening. It was wonderful to see you. I, God willing, hope that I will visit Halifax sooner than later. I admit it's the first time in years that I have not been in Halifax for more than a year. So it's difficult for me to say that, and I hope and pray that the time is not so far away where I'll be able to visit Halifax. And if you would like, It would be my pleasure while there to continue this conversation. If you want to have a live class, with pleasure. It was a pleasure speaking to you, and hopefully I'll see you in person sooner than later. Have a good day, everyone, and a very good week ahead. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Nice to see you.
And Rabbi Kirshner, I see, is at the Sheva Brachas, but we'll thank him even if he's not here for organizing it.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day, everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.
Regards to the family.
Thank you.